Hello, my name is Jody Lee Mott, and welcome to Dream Gardens, where we talk up the kids' books we love. Back in my first podcast, I talked about how the title of this podcast, Dream Gardens, came from two attributed quotes whose authenticity was a little suspect. That made me think of other familiar quotes that are often passed around, and whether their origin might be just as dubious. One quote in particular came to mind that frequently comes up regarding books for children. It's attributed to G.K. Chesterton, the late 19th and early 20th century English writer and critic, and it usually goes like this. Fairy tales do not tell children that dragons exist. Children already know that dragons exist. Fairy tales tell children that dragons can be killed. The quote is often used as a defense against the argument that children's books are frivolous, and that they actually help the child deal with the difficulties and the fears they'll face in life. As it turns out, the quote is not entirely fictional, although the wording has been altered a great deal. The original source of the quote comes from an essay Chesterton wrote called The Red Angel in his book Tremendous Trifles. It reads as follows. Fairy tales, then, are not responsible for producing in children fear or any of the shapes of fear. Fairy tales do not give the child the idea of the evil or the ugly. That is in the child already, because it is in the world already. Fairy tales do not give the child his first idea of bogey. What fairy tales give the child is his first clear idea of the possible defeat of bogey. The baby has known the dragon intimately ever since he had an imagination. What the fairy tale provides for him is a Saint George to kill the dragon. The idea here is pretty much the same, even if a bit wordier and darker in tone. So does this mean we should ignore the altered quote because it isn't actually what he said word for word? I don't think so. It is good to know the original quote, of course, but it doesn't invalidate the reworded one. There's still a great deal of truth in it, and it's a little more accessible for the average reader. But it is equally true that if you find yourself using the modern quote, you should at least acknowledge that while it may represent the spirit of Chesterton's words, the words themselves are not his. My guest today is Erin Brown, an author, speaker, teacher, and motivator. Her blog, FUP, is a space set up for entrepreneurs, writers, and other creative people. It can be found at erinbrownconroy.wordpress.com. Thank you for joining me today, Erin.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I just want to ask you a couple questions before we talk about the book. First, about your website, the name of it, FUP. Why FUP?
Well, a while back, another writer friend and I were talking about how we always have coffee when we write and, you know, having that cup of coffee in hand and getting ready and sitting down and working and sipping the coffee. And oftentimes it was at a coffee shop such as a Starbucks or other, you know, place where you have the styrofoam, or not styrofoam, it's like a cardboard cup. And the sound of the two cardboard cups saying cheers together and hitting edges is kind of like a book sound. So it's a cheers. It's a motion of cheers together. And so that's a theme of the blog. It's cheers across the miles. Cheers to those who write, who create, who focus on making things for other people.
Now, I understand that you have, you're starting this nonfiction writing series, the Simplified Writing Series. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. Well, actually, there are two books already out in the series. One is called Simplified Writing 101. Actually, it was written many years ago, six, 7 years ago, and was published and republished again. And it's used in college writing programs and some high school online writing programs. It's used in some public schools. And it's how to write in an academic setting for academics. But it's very simple, simplified writing. We take one concept each chapter, and it's a lot of fun and witty, and so it captures the attention and easy to learn, easy to read through. So there's another book in the series that's a vocabulary, simplified vocabulary guide that's also used in AP English Language and Composition courses. And we have a whole series coming, six middle school writing books, how to write, but also simplified blog writing and simplified, you name it, for writing. I've been a professional writer for many, many years, and I have a master in fine arts, MFA, in fiction writing. And so I'm kind of putting all that in, and many years of teaching as well. I've been at this, I'm older than I sound, been at this a long time. My oldest daughter is 34, and just really felt like it was time to make it simple, make it easy, make it accessible. So this series of books is just a lot of fun, a lot of wit and charm, and making writing easily understood.
Now the book you chose is called it's the Tripod Trilogy. Yes. By John Christopher. It was originally published in 1967-68 by Hamish Hamilton, then later by Simon & Schuster in the U.S. And it's actually a series of three books, The White Mountains, The City of Gold and Lead, and The Pool of Fire. So what can you tell readers who are unfamiliar with these books, what they're about?
Well, these were what we call the magic books. My magic books, my friend and mentor and writer, Russell Davis, who was a former Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America president and also was my thesis advisor for my MFA program. He had us, during our program, talk about our magic books, the books that really inspired us and drove us and opened up our creativity and drew us to be a writer. And this series was just that for me. I was about 8. Maybe when this came out, I'll tell you my age there. So it's in the future, and civilization has fallen, as it were, and it's become more like the serfs and the kings and the landowners and small cities, small towns. And in that, the tripods, which are these great tall metal, they're like domes. To me, think about a water tower. Whenever I was little, I read the series and we drove by the water towers. I would think, there's a tripod. They're the great beings that kind of ruled the world. And when you turned to be a young man or woman at 14, you were capped. And that means that the big jerk tripod came down to your town and with its long tentacles scooped you up and took you up into its dome. And then later that day deposited you back silver cap on your head. And this cap controlled you. We know that later on in the series, but it was a mark of becoming a young man or woman. And the protagonist, the hero of the story, is 13, and he sees his cousin, Jack, go through this capping ceremony and come back different, come back, subservient. And he gets the stirring and the feeling of this is not what he wants for his life. And so the story follows him actually escaping the town. And it's a hero's journey story. And I didn't know that back then, of course. I just knew as a preteen that this was adventure and that the things that this young boy experienced were feelings that I had. And he got to go and do and be and explore and travel. And that's kind of what I wanted to do. It was my escape book as a young child. So it very much so is a hero's journey story where the young protagonist, what they call Bildungsroman, the young protagonist who's growing up and he leaves home. He meets a mentor, herald kind of a person who comes as a vagrant. A vagrant is someone who's been capped. And it didn't sit well with them. It drove them crazy. And so there are vagrants around the city or of the town, and this vagrant comes into town but starts a conversation with young Will, the protagonist, and Will realizes that this is not really a vagrant, this is somebody who has a brain, they're not crazy, and he is trying to recruit young boys and young girls to escape to the White Mountains and fight back against this horrible race that has enslaved humans. So, of course, our young hero does escape his town, and his cousin goes with him. And along the way, they meet up a young man, Jean-Paul, which they thought he's saying Beanpole. He's French. And so they call him Beanpole. And so the three of them go on a journey. And it's much like Harry Potter in that way, where there are three children together experiencing, very distinct personalities, experiencing this journey and this escape across, trying to get to the White Mountains. So that's just a short version of what happens in the story. But lots of adventure, lots of the journey and escape and wonderful things that young people enjoy and dream about.
You mentioned that it was your magic book, yes. The one that sort of helped you to become a writer. So what was it about it that really spoke to you that said, I'd really want to become a writer because of this book?
Well, there are a couple things. You know, like I said, I didn't know this was the hero's journey. This story that many stories follow, where a hero sets off on a path and embarks on a journey, and in the process discovers something about himself, and also gets to the goal at the end. So it had this hero's journey story that really felt good and felt right. And if you go through the book, he follows the hero's journey super well, even to the point there's a part in the hero's journey or Blake Snyder calls, you know, he has the Blake Snyder beat sheet for film where you have certain steps and things that happen in a story. There's a part, the belly of the whale, it's called, where you actually get into, like Jonah in the belly of the whale and the belly of the beast. In the story, you get into the heart of your antagonist, your bad guy. There's a part in here where he gets into the middle of he gets picked up by a tripod and gets inside of it. And so it follows that cool story. But also, like I said, it kind of meshes the science fiction, which I love. I write science fiction as well. And it's film and SF is something I really enjoy. And it combines that science fiction, cool, strange, new world, creatures, aliens, along with historical feeling. And if you get the newer 2014 version of this series, John Christopher actually has a part at the beginning that he writes about how he didn't want to do just straight science fiction, and he didn't want to do just straight historical. So he blended the two. And so that blend really drew me, because I like things with kings and queens and knights and fantasy as well. And I like, you know, My Side of the Mountain was another wonderful book that I loved as a child, because again, he got on his own. He had this bird, you know, that, and he got to live on the mountain by himself. Again, that sense of adventure. So couple that story with the two genres that I love. And also the description in this book, I think, is done super well. I love description. That's, you know, part of fantasy writing and even science fiction, more so with fantasy. But, you know, he has beautiful description that's not bogged down. A lot of us as writers, we get bogged down in description. And, you know, we call it the info dump or the description dump, where we just, you know, get so many details and we get out of the action of the story. Other stories move too fast. You know, it's all action, 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 and you're missing the world. The setting isn't as rich and experiential as you want. What I love about these books is, to me, they have a nice balance. He gets to do his rich, descriptive writing, but at the same time, it moves. It doesn't just sit there. The story moves along. Now, this author is a really skilled author. He actually had 30 books published in adult fiction before he wrote these children fiction books. He was actually approached, as I understand it, by a London publisher and said, hey, we'd like you to write stories for children. And he was like, oh, I'm not sure I want to do this. But he did. And, you know, he says he was schooled, because he wrote the books and thought it was great, turned them in. And then his editors were like, no, we need to redo this. And he said he felt really funny going back as a very published, well-known author, going back and having to be told to rewrite a chapter or rewrite the beginning, you know? So, you know, he's a skilled writer, and it's really fun for me to read books where I can see what they're doing. And intentionally, good writers write intentionally. Good writers know storyline, and they know the characters, the archetypes in story, and they purposefully, intentionally slide those things in to create solid story. And I see that. Now, I didn't know it as a child, but something, I could see something there. And as I go back, I go, oh, look, wow, that Herald is pretty strong. He's mixing the Herald and the Mentor, and he did it a great job of it, you know. Or, like I said, the belly of the whale moment, where he actually gets inside the tripod. And spoiler alert, they have found grenades. And that comes to play in conquering this big beast, this big tripod. So very fun.
Now, I usually ask at the end to share a passage, but since you've been talking about how the description of the book is so important, I was wondering if you want to share that now, just give people an idea of of the language that he uses.
Sure. And I do want to say it's interesting. He uses adverbs, and if there are any writers out there listening, you know, it's like, oh, don't use those ly words, right? He uses them. he breaks rules, but he seems to do it with grace and do it in a way that I you know, is acceptable. So you'll find some adverbs and things in. But here's where actually we first meet the tripod itself, this large creature that's metallic that to me looks like a water tower. So the booming came nearer, and then suddenly we could see it over the roofs of the houses to the south, the great hemisphere of gleaming metal rocking through the air above the three articulated legs, several times as high as the church. Its shadow came before it and fell on us when we halted, two of its legs astride the river. We waited, and I was shivering in earnest now, unable to halt the tremors that ran through my body. So that's kind of fun. At the point where this creature takes his cousin up, it says, the burnished tentacles came down gently and precisely, and its tip curled about Jack's waist and lifted him up to where a hole opened like a mouth in the hemisphere and swallowed him. In the afternoon, there were games, and people moved about the village, visiting, laughing, and talking. And the young men and women who were unmarried strolled together in the fields. Then in the evening, there was the feast, with tables set up in the street, since the weather held fair, and the smell of roast beef mixing with the smells of beer and cider and lemonade, and all kinds of cakes and puddings. Lamps were hung outside the houses. In the dusk, they'd be lit and glow like yellow blossoms among the street. But before the feast started, Jack was brought back to us. There was a distant booming first, and the quietness and waiting, and the tread of the gigantic feet shaking the earth. The tripod halted as before, and the mouth opened in the side of the hemisphere, and then the tentacle swept down and carefully set Jack by the place which had been left for him. At Sir Geoffrey's right hand, I was a long way away with the children at the far end, but I could see him clearly. He looked pale, but otherwise, his face did not seem any different. The difference was in his white shaved head, on which the darker metal tracery of the cap stood out like a spider web. His hair would soon grow again over and around the metal, and with thick black hair such as he had, in a few months the cap would be almost unnoticeable, but it would be there all the same, a part of him, now till the day he died. So to me, it just sounds like I'm going to jump on a horse at a feast, but at the same time, we have this big tentacle coming down and grabbing the child by the waist. So that dichotomy, that mix of the two worlds, really fascinates me.
Oh, thank you for sharing that. Now, when we first meet Will Parker, who's our protagonist, in his village at the beginning of the book, it's a very pleasant place to live. Everybody seems happy and content, and nobody really wants anything to change. And even Will is that way at the very beginning of the book. And I think this is a theme he visits continually throughout the series, that most people in this new world are quite okay with the way things are.
That's right.
And do you think he's trying to suggest something about human nature in general? Just the fact that most people, you think this in this sort of dystopian future, most people are pretty okay with the way things are and would rather not have it change.
I think you're absolutely right. And later in the book too, he, again, a little spoiler alert here, will actually meets up with a royal family. He's ill, falls ill, and a royal family of sorts in the countryside takes him in and cares for him, and it's utopia for him. It's wonderful with and a beautiful daughter, a beautiful girl, and a little bit of a love interest there. And he's lulled into a sense of security there, where actually Henry and Beanpole leave without him. And he says, I'm going to stay. And that to me is another allegory of we can get lulled into a sense of peace that's a false sense of peace. And of course, there's a nice shocking moment when he finds out, I won't tell you if this is a spoiler, but he realizes at kind of the last minute, oh my gosh, I've got to get out of here. This is very dangerous. And he steals a horse, jumps on a horse, and catches up with Henry and Beanpole. Not before more trouble, of course. but I think you're spot on. That's the sense of almost like the frog in the pot. You know what I'm talking about? how we get in the frog that sits in the pot that warms up and cooks the frog. And so much of our lives, I think, can be like that, you know, where we think things are okay, but we're sliding. And we get to the point where we all of a sudden kind of wake up and say, whoa, not where we want to be, whether it's in society as a whole or even us as individuals. So yeah, there are a lot of really cool allegorical parallels in this story too.
Now, you mentioned about that scene where Will has to make, in the castle, where he has to make a decision. And he's not quite sure if he wants to do the right thing or just kind of take a way that's a little bit easier, that seems a little bit more relaxed. And he does a few other things. I think about at the island where he steals the boat from this hermit. So even though he's the hero of the book, he does a few unheroic things throughout the book. He's not a typical, you know, always the good guy, you know, and he makes decisions that he regrets later on quite a bit. So I just want to talk a little bit this idea of this sort of an unheroic hero.
Well, I think that's fabulous because it creates us this sense of he's like me. You know, if we have a hero, any writer that writes a hero too big and too large that we can't relate to, we don't want to read. You know, we want to have a hero that has faults and problems and motivations that aren't pure, because that's the human condition. And in the end, yes, we want the hero to come out at the end, but we want to see the failures as well. So this is a note to writers listening, you know, that to make our heroes struggle and make bad decisions is a good thing in story writing. And, you know, to be able to relate to that hero, I think we do need to have, everybody makes mistakes, right? So the fact that we do with those mistakes, and I like personally to have stories that, yes, we finally come around. I think we all have that yearning inside of us to have the end of the story work out. Not always as we want it to, but to have a portion resolved, to have some kind of resolution. Very important, again, for writers, and helps us to feel good as readers.
Speaking of writing decisions, he also makes another choice with the tripods. We don't actually find till about halfway through the second book what's the secret of the tripods, you know, what's really going on there. And I just thought, what do you think, you know, there's sort of this menacing presence before then. We don't really know what's going on, but there's this very menacing presence throughout, at least through the halfway of the second book. And then we find out a little bit more about them, about what they really are. Well, what do you think about that? And do you think, are they more interesting? This is sort of a personal thing. Are they more interesting before or after, or don't you think it makes any difference?
You know, I think timing is everything, right? And so we're talking about exposing to the reader the secrets and the things that drive our story, and that suspense of who are these things, you know, what are they all about, really, like you said, drives the whole book. You never know. All we know is they're menacing, they're horrible, they actually hurt people, they kill people. You know, we see some very menacing moments with where people are they hunt them like a dog would hunt an animal. The tripods hunt humans. So again, spoiler alert, there's a part there that's quite scary, especially for middle grade readers. But what this does is it takes us to a place, I think, in book two, book three, where we feel, even though we meet who these people are, and a little bit of a spoiler alert there, we realize that they have done some really awful things. And it's okay for our hero to, you know, do what he does in the end and overcome the bad guys. And again, I won't do any spoilers because book three, you know, as they do conquer, and it's a very cool story. But I think it's all in timing. Was I disappointed? No, there was a BBC television show, if you knew that. I used to watch this as a child in the 80s, and they did a show of this. It was a very popular book, by the way. You know, this, like you said, 1967, 68, and 68 were the three publishing dates. And it's become a classic because in the 80s, it became the television show from the BBC. Also, it was shown in Australia. And I didn't like the television show. It did not do my imagination well. You know, it's kind of like Narnia. Remember the BBC production of Narnia? You know, there was something charming about it, but then there was something disappointing too, because they didn't have the CGI and all the fun things that we have now. So if you do ever get a hold of those things, I don't know if they're on YouTube or not, but seeing the antagonists was disappointing to me because I saw them as much more menacing and horrible than they could portray on television. So your question of timing and, you know, do you tell who these horrible people are? Did it work? I think it worked for him. It worked for me as a reader. I'm writing a series right now that's a science fiction fantasy kind of blend. It's a science fantasy. And I do the same kind of thing. I think I took some of this feeling into my own stories, where it's not until book two and into three, really, where you're really understanding what's going on. And I think it's okay to do, if you do it well.
Now, we've talked a bit about the tripods and Will, but there's a few other secondary characters in the book as well. We talked about Beanpole, sort of scientifically minded, Fritz, who's a bit more methodical, Ulf, who's a little bit cantankerous, Henry, who's kind of an interesting arc in the book, and the leader, Julius. I don't know if any of those particular secondary characters kind of really stand out for you as an interesting character.
Great question. And I want to say that each of them are memorable in their own right. And in that way, like I said, it's kind of like the three in Harry Potter, the three main characters. Later on, again, you said we bring in Fritz. And they're strong characters. They're memorable characters, which is, again, something I absolutely love in anyone's story. I love that we had Beanpole's intelligence at work. He was the calm, meticulous, and brilliant mind that was working there. Not to say that Will wasn't smart, you know, as the hero, but he just brought this whole flavor. Henry, it's interesting the arc because I hate Henry at the beginning of the book. I think everybody does not like Henry. He's the Eustace of Narnia fame at the beginning of the book and has a fabulous arc. Fabulous. And I wish I could do the spoiler alert on him, but he's the arc that I think all writers should write in every character, because he comes from a place of low selfishness and brash impetuousness, and becomes quite the sacrificial team player. So I love that arc. I think it's fabulous.
Oh, it is. It is. I just have one more question for you. We're coming up on the 50th year of this book when it was first published. What do you think this book's, for the younger readers today, what does this book still have to say for readers who are just encountering it for the first time?
I like it. It's the dystopian story. You know, dystopian stories have become so overworked, overused today. It's the dystopian story that is unique. And I think it's the writing has made it a classic, like the Amber series by Roger Zelazny. Been around a long time, very strong. That's an adult series, fantasy series. Yeah, they're just, the writing is good. The storyline is, you know, every story has its little tweaks that can happen, but for the most part, good story. I think that what it has to say is that we still worry about the future, right? That's the whole thing with dystopian literature. Everybody worries about the future, but the hope is in the young people. The hope is in the ability to work together as a team. You know, the themes in this book are those really solid themes of hope that are really the themes of Star Wars, you know, the New Hope, the themes of so many, gosh, Captain America. You know, you can name a lot of the very popular films now with teamwork and hope, and that's the underlying bedrock of this story.
Thank you so much for joining me today and sharing this book. You know, I've never had a chance to read it before, or I just wasn't aware of it. So it was really nice to be able to read this book, and like a brand new book for me.
Absolutely. I have to ask you a question now. What did you like about the book? Because, like, I'm biased. It was my magic book when I was younger, so I'm biased about it. I've got this warm, fuzzy feeling. What, you reading it the first time, what did you think?
Well, I think I mentioned before this idea of Will is not the sort of perfect character, that he makes mistakes, that he gets things wrong, that he wants to give up a lot. And that, to me, that's very interesting as a character. Sometimes in books like this, characters have things too easy, or they seem so wonderful that it's hard to aspire to be somebody like that. But Will is, somebody I think very identifiable. And I think the idea of these tripods that we don't quite understand, I thought was an interesting sort of take. You know, he trusts the reader enough to not know a lot going into the story. And as a reader, I do appreciate that rather than trying to explain everything all at once. He trusts the reader that, something interesting is going to happen. Stick with me, trust me, and I won't let you down. And he doesn't.
Yeah. And as a parent, I want to say that I would feel very comfortable giving these books to my kids and using them as talking points too. There are a lot of conversations that can be had from these books as well.
Oh, absolutely. I agree. I'm a parent myself, so I'd absolutely agree. Well, thank you again for joining me.
I'm very glad you asked me to be here. Thank you.
Thank you for joining me on Dream Gardens. The theme music, titled All Together, is provided courtesy of Purple Planet Music. You can visit them at www.purple-planet.com. Podcast cover art is provided by Creative Pro 180, courtesy of Fiverr, which can be found at www.fiverr.com. You can find out more about me at jleemott.com. That's jleemott.com, or contact me at jodymott@gmail.com. Until next time, keep dreaming, keep growing, and keep reading.